planet's puppet masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zayas.
Where would we be without THC? 'Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
People, by now we know all too well that hidden behind the facade of democracy are the dynastic families that make up the bricks and mortar of the power pyramid. Groomed from a young age, pre-approved for the finest schools, and inducted into their elusive and exclusive secret societies, we see the same names and faces fast-tracked to wealth, power, and control, while the rest of us are force-fed the American dream like an overstuffed Christmas goose. And among your Rockefellers, Morgans, DuPonts, and Windsors, you have the Bushes, one of the more public-facing families when it comes to America's puppet masters. But with deep roots in the oil industry, the Skull and Bone Society, and the CIA, should it be any wonder that both a father and son and nearly brother have wedged their way into the highest office of the land like it wasn't no thing? Well, today we're going to hold the Bushes under the microscope with Russ Baker, who is the well-accomplished founder and editor of the great news site whowhatwhy.org and author of the biggest and best book I've seen on the Bushes, weighing in at a little over 500 pages, Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. It's an honor and a pleasure to welcome in a journalist who's digging deeper than most these days. Russ, my man, welcome to the Higher Side.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Thanks for doing it. I know your book's been out for a few years now, but it's no less important. And when trying to identify some of the hidden hands that are working the American machine, start us off by talking a little bit about the journey, because this is a pretty massive undertaking. What drove you to focus on the Bushes and to dig so much deeper than most others have?
Well, it goes back to 2003 as the Iraq War was about to get underway, and I could see that the Bush administration wanted to go to war, and it was clear to me that they were creating a justification. I couldn't understand why the press couldn't see it. 2004, I was covering Bush's reelection, sort of astonished at the fact that despite his having clearly lied about the basis for the war, that there he was running for reelection and doing pretty well. And I saw how he was able to suppress various potential scandals about himself and also to put on the defensive John Kerry, a man who otherwise should have dominated that election, especially since it was coming out that Bush's Vietnam War record was very questionable, and Kerry was known to have been on a swift boat and in very dangerous service. And so I was surprised at how well the Bushes did to sort of bottle up their problems and put Kerry on the defensive. And I did some reporting on that in 2004. That got me more and more interested in the Bush family itself. And I began saying, how are they able to bottle all these things up? That then got me trying to ask questions about them and their own trajectory to power, the larger constellation of people who supported them, abetted them, were behind them. And that just got me asking questions. It led me to look not just at George W. Bush, but at his father, George H.W. Bush, and then at the grandfather, trying to understand the whole family's remarkable relationship to American history. And that really was an open-ended inquiry, led to the 5 years that I spent on Family of Secrets.
And so obviously we know the Bushes are a multi-generational dynasty. How far back were you able to take this family?
I went back quite a few generations. The first indications I saw of a fledgling power center go all the way back to the sort of mid-1800s. And I can't remember how much of this ended up in the book or on the cutting room floor because I just had so much good stuff. But basically, I saw a ancestor who had relocated to Rochester, New York, where he became a town clerk and befriended somebody who was involved with the founding of Skull and Bones. And that was very, very important to me. And then the son of that man, say it was the son or the grandson, was a minister to some of the wealthiest congregations in America. He really got to know all the right people. And there were indications that he himself may have been involved in the Navy with early intelligence work. So he already showed a guy by the name of James Bush, Reverend James Bush. And then we go to his son. So we get pretty quickly to the Bush, who then moves to Columbus, Ohio, where he gets into the manufacturing of parts for the railroad industry and gets hooked up to not one, but two branches of that's a Samuel Bush of the Rockefeller family. Mm-hmm. That's where we start seeing that level of connection very visible. And that man himself gets sent to Washington to become the main point man for the procurement of small arms for World War I. He has been chosen by these dynasties, the DuPonts and what have you, who own these giant arms manufacturing companies and want to make sure that the U.S. does get into World War I and that their products are in play. There are also families like the Rockefellers and so on who are looking strategically at the spoils, looking at the tremendous oil supplies to be had. Places like Azerbaijan, you know, became part of the former Soviet Union. And so see generation after generation, then Samuel Bush's son, Prescott Bush, who goes to school at Yale and is in Skull and Bones and befriends the Harriman brothers. And they then go into business with a investment banking firm called Brown Brothers Harriman, which becomes one of the major private and very discreet banks of the super wealthy, with operations all over the world, including tentacles into the bankers that bankrolled Adolf Hitler. And so it's it's quite an astonishing journey for that family. And it's a family that themselves were never really all that wealthy, but they certainly were powerful and they certainly were the go-to people for those who were extremely wealthy in terms of being able to carry out their agendas.
Mm. Yeah, and you do such a great job in the book. And I love those earlier threads because they are kind of the hardest to get a hold of. But from listening to your previous interviews and reading the book, I've heard that their family goes back to someone being an informant in the Civil War. One ancestor was burned at the stake as a witch. Another one was made to walk the plank by pirates. So some people have been kind of wise to their game over the years, it seems.
It's an interesting story. I think there's another book in going back to the very, very early family history, certainly.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, shows like this call it conspiring and business circles call it networking, but that really has been one of their key tools, hasn't it?
That's right. I mean, I think most successful people understand the singular importance of connections. And what some people call conspiracy, I think, is really the ultimate in working connections, developing working connections, maintaining those networks and those relationships. And the Bush family was absolutely unsurpassed. By the time you got to George H.W. or Poppy Bush, he really was evincing this in the form of things like his Christmas card list, which I'm trying to remember what it had. It's tens of thousands of people would get Christmas cards from them every year, but they just maintain these tremendous networks. Most of us, you know, may talk to a few of our relatives or something, but I mean, they stayed in touch with every single one on every level. You know, the Kennedys also were fairly good at it, but the Bushes really were just totally unsurpassed in keeping track of everybody they'd ever met. And not just that, but of course, there are the ways in which these people cooperate. So you see the joining of the various kinds of associations, some of them overt, some of them covert. You see them running certain channels into certain kinds of military service, more elite. People like Prescott Bush appears to have worked in military intelligence in World War I, just like his grandfather in the Navy. And so you see those kind of patterns. You see them joining the social groups. In many cases, these kind of quasi or fully Masonic enterprises. You see them certainly in their business ventures, in the choices of the people that they married, very similar to what the royal families of Europe would do. Careful calculations in that regard. And so they really worked that to the maximum. And this, of course, is exactly the sort of framework which enables you to do things outside of the public eye.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Brown Brothers Harriman, and that is one of the pieces of the puzzle that I knew least about. And it was one of the key questions I had for you. I wrote down a quote from your book where you say that understanding the role of Brown Brothers Harriman is central to understanding the Bush legacy and the vast, if unprecedented, influence of the Bush's inner circle. Can you elaborate on them at all? Is there anything more to say on that other than, of course, they financed the German side of World War II to an extent?
Yeah, I mean, Brown Brothers Harriman was originally the Brown Brothers Bank, and this came out of the mills of England. They came to America. They were involved in all sorts of things, in a cotton trade, some connections to the Confederacy, and they ended up banking on the East Coast, Baltimore, and then other places. And this was a very important pillar of the Anglo aristocracy connections into America. And then the Harrimans were this railroad dynasty. And when the old man E.H. Harriman died, his two young sons at that time in college took over this whole thing. And they had all of this money and all of this corporate power and were not sure what to do with it. And they then brought in a man named George Herbert Walker. And this was the father-in-law of Prescott Bush. And he was a prominent investment banker based in St. Louis. He was actually one of the most important money figures in America, though very little known in general. And he was brought in. He moved to New York, and they merged the Harrimans into Brown Brothers, and it became Brown Brothers Harriman. And then Prescott Bush was brought in, and he eventually became a partner there. Brown Brothers Harriman, because it was private, it was not publicly traded, did not have to do the kinds of filings that public companies did, was able to very discreetly handle the monies of some of the most exclusive families in this country. And the Brown Brothers, if you go back even before it was Brown Brothers Harriman, it was already involved in shaping much of American policy. You can find I believe it was a 1922 issue of The Nation magazine. The cover story was it was called The Republic of Brown Brothers, and it was about how they were so influential. They were almost like a country unto themselves. They could get the U.S. government to invade Nicaragua when their clients, companies like the United Fruit, Standard Fruit, and what have you, were threatened. Their interests were threatened by the peoples of those countries who were put upon rather severely, virtually enslaved, working under horrible conditions. The governments of those countries throughout Central America, much of South America, were really what they called these banana republic governments. They were often put into power and sustained by the forces like United Fruit and so on, and in turn, outfits like Brown Brothers Harriman, and then major corporate corporate law firms of the sorts like Sullivan and Cromwell, the firm out of which Allen and John Dulles came. And this is how all these people got to know each other. And then, of course, you see John Foster Dulles becomes the Secretary of State under Eisenhower. His brother Allen becomes the most influential director of the early Central Intelligence Agency. He's a close friend of Prescott Bush. And so all of these entities are fundamentally focused on protecting the wealth and the interests and the power of this relatively small number of families that were and continue to dominate America.
Yeah, it is a fascinating story how they do this. And you mentioned Yale and the Skull and Bone Society, which is that bullet point is about as far as a lot of people dig when it comes to these connections. They know that he was in Skull and Bones, but that's about it. And that is an organization built for high-level networking. Did Skull and Bones come up beyond just a club they were in while in college?
You know, I certainly it's a secret society, and they're all sworn not to reveal too much about the details. There are several books on Skull and Bones. My sense was that, you know, people poo-poo these things, and if you start talking about them, they kind of try to make fun of you. But what I always say is, look, the people who were members didn't think that it was something to be poo-pooed. They put great store in getting in and being a member. They thought this was extremely important. Now, unless you want to dismiss them as silly people, those who went on to becoming some of the most powerful and influential people in America, I think we ought to take it seriously and respect it. And what it was, well, that's hard to say what it is. That's hard to say. I think certainly people join these things for a sense of belonging, just like they join fraternities and sororities. They want to be accepted by other by elites. They want to get a leg up. There's a sense of, you know, you're special. You're the elect. Mm-hmm. And so you join and you have to make certain sacrifices. You have to presumably do certain rituals in many cases, skull and bones, and in others, humiliate or debase yourself to prove how badly you want to be in. And then you swear oaths of loyalty and of secrecy. And of course, once you've done that, that's a lifelong thing. Flash forward to the 2004 presidential election, where the extraordinary set of circumstances where the nominees of the two major parties were both from Yale and were both for members of Skull and Bones. And even John Kerry, the liberal, when asked about it, said, it's secret. I can't talk about it. Now, you know, what does that mean? They were obviously able to face off in a pretty tough campaign against each other. But, for example, Kerry seemed in some cases to sort of hold his fire. Some people thought he might have won if he had not done so. And you do wonder what they have on each other and what they've agreed to do and not to do, and their notion of, you know, sort of splitting up the pie and all of that. So it is not all that well understood. And I think all of these secret organizations deserve much, much more scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously, from what I've heard, blackmail plays a huge role in these secret societies. You know, you get somebody to do something embarrassing, like you mentioned, or something uncouth. And then if you put that person into a position of power years later, you've got that dirt on them. So if you put people in powerful positions and then you stay in the shadows, you can get them to do a lot to not have those dirty secrets from back in the day revealed.
That's right. And there's no question that blackmail, particularly relating to sexual matters, but also to other things, has played a very important role in American politics. Maybe less so if you go back to the 19th century and part of the 20th century, where the press had an understanding that they were not to speak about certain things. They remained quiet about, for example, Franklin Roosevelt's health, John F. Kennedy's health. There were many, many things they did not talk about. Many, if not most, of the presidents had lovers, and they did not talk about that. At some point, that changed, and as that began to change, all bets were off. And because America is sort of famous for its somewhat Victorian mores in public, at least, this put these people very much on the defensive, and they understood that if they were to get into power or remain in power, that they could not afford for any of these things to come out. So yes, blackmail, very, very important. And all we have to do is look at people like Gary Hart and John Edwards and Ted Kennedy, and we can go on and on and on. I mean, these things, when they came out, really damaged them, kept them from becoming president. So the ability to have to be ensure that whatever there was about you that perhaps made you all too human, to make sure that did not come out, I think was part of all this. And certainly in the course of my research, I've seen all sorts of things about George W. Bush and his father and the grandfather and so on that never did come out, and that the public to this day doesn't know about. And perhaps it was these, to some extent, it was these networks that were protecting them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are some great revelations in the book. Obviously, we're going to get to them. But one more question about kind of the older generations and wealth creation. Tell us about Dresser Industries. This is one of the places where Prescott seemed to make at least a little bit of his money, as I understand, right?
Yeah, Dresser Industries went back to the early days of the oil industry, and it was what became known as an oil services company. It didn't actually prospect or drill for oil or refine petroleum products. It provided all kinds of other things, from well drilling equipment and derricks and what have you, drills and so forth. And Brown Brothers Harriman took over, bought out Dresser Industries, and then they appointed a friend of Prescott Bush to run the company, fellow by the name of Neil Mallon. And you see these names again and again, just like George Herbert Walker becomes the name that goes throughout the Bush family. They even do it with some of their friends. So George W. Bush's brother, Neil, his name is actually Neil Mallon Bush.
Right.
So they named him after this friend of the family, Uncle Neil, who really wasn't in the family at all. And he, Neil Mallon, was just basically told that he would run this company. There's a story in my book, Family of Secrets, about that, where he comes back from, he's young and he's climbing mountains and traveling around Europe and carefree, and they just call him in and say, okay, now you have to run this company. And it's kind of amazing to hear those stories. There's another one with Dick Cheney, where Dick Cheney was, you know, la-di-da-di-da, and he's out on a hunting trip. And while he's out hunting, some of the other people on the trip are at the lodge, and they've decided that he's going to take over and run another company called Halliburton. And eventually, by the way, Dresser and Halliburton become merged and part of the same company. And so these are the untold stories of the infrastructure of so much of American industry and how these things are connected. Now, Dresser Industries interested me a great deal because I saw the role that it played very much as a cooperative entity with the American intelligence apparatus. Mm-hmm. And Dresser Industries not only provided cover for people working in intelligence, I found documents where they were briefing or talking to people in the CIA, including Alan Dulles, about various enterprises in the Caribbean, dealing with Castro and what have you. And they also provided a job for a young George H.W. Bush when he was starting out, and I guess we'll get into that later, but ended up that that was essentially a kind of a no-show job that was cover for him so that he could do intelligence work.
Yeah, it must be nice to have the lodge just setting up company after company to put you at the head of. Wish we were all so lucky. But to jump ahead a little bit, one of the big revelations in Family of Secrets is Poppy's secret life. And, you know, a lot of people know that Poppy Bush, H.W. Bush, was director of the CIA for 1 year in 1976. But I've heard a lot of researchers suggest that his ties go much deeper. But you actually connect quite a few dots along with another researcher, Joseph McBride, to make a pretty conclusive case that his ties to the CIA go much deeper, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, McBride and one other person had found some obscure overlooked documents, memos that referenced a George Bush as being in the CIA in some capacity dating back to 1963 at the time of John F. Kennedy's assassination. And these stories came out in the late 80s as George H.W. Bush, then vice president, was about to be anointed president. And they were pretty much suppressed, but they were important stories. And I took a close look at that and wondered, well, what did this all mean? And was that the same man or was that not? Through my research, I concluded that, in fact, it was the same man, that he had, in fact, been involved with intelligence work, not just in 1976 when Gerald Ford appointed him CIA director as a supposed neophyte with no background or particular qualifications to be CIA director. That never made any sense to me. I started looking at that separately and on my own, saying, why was this guy made CIA director? And that's when I really started looking at these documents that these others had unearthed and trying to do what I could to figure out what he was doing, what his trajectory was. And that got me into looking at some of the early papers of his own oil company called Zapata Oil, and concluding to my own, and I think most people's satisfaction, that the company was little more than itself a cover entity for espionage work. Zapata Offshore was a small company that seemed never to turn a profit, yet they were traveling all over the world constantly, always in hot spots and often in places where they had no seeming offshore drilling business. And I could see what that was, and I began to map out George H.W. Bush's connections to all these other fellows who also had gone to these Ivy League schools and grown up together, and they were there was no question that they were very important, very high level CIA people. And this developed this notion of this whole constellation of sort of this substrata of American power, where these corporations and these banks and these oil companies are kind of operating seamlessly with the largely and almost completely opaque, mysterious American intelligence apparatus, the foreign policy apparatus, and so on, that I began to see how this was a all of it together, a means of perpetuating the influence, wealth, and impact of this relatively small American elite.
Mm-hmm. And with the CIA connections, it's really interesting because something you talk about in the book that I hadn't really considered is that before there was an official CIA or Office of Strategic Services, major companies had their own private agents and spies. So it makes perfect sense that when these government agencies opened, they'd hire some of these agents. And that's problematic right from the start, isn't it?
Yeah. And in fact, governments always had a stream of intelligence, if you want to call it that, of reports that they used, even without having formal spy agencies. The United States, well, first of all, the military had always served as, you know, always the military intelligence had existed for a long time. I think as long as it's been military, there's always been an intelligence component because, of course, you know, scouts and collecting information about the enemy troops has always been a core function of any military. Mm-hmm. And then on non-military matters, you had these companies going abroad. Well, they were doing business and they were having problems and they were collecting information. They were conveying it to the American State Department and to others, to their own networks back home. And so this was the main method. In fact, Franklin Roosevelt was firmly against creating a non-military peacetime intelligence organization. He saw it as dangerous, a potential threat to democracy. He was rather prescient, I think, in that regard. But yes, there are these informal networks. And then what happened was the great American corporations, Ford Motor Company, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, which United Fruit and so on, they were doing essentially their own intelligence gathering. And of course, you know, they had their operations all over the world and their relationships with these leaders and dictators. And so they had all their information coming through. And so that when the CIA was created, it was very easy to sort of continue operating through these entities. IBM was another one. Believe it or not, the Singer Sewing Machine Company, which is regarded mm-hmm. as the world's first multinational corporation. They all were in this game.
Yeah, man. And it's really impressive that you've been able to put all this together and these HW CIA secret life connections, because Poppy Bush has been notoriously careful about his paper trail ever since the early days in the Navy, hasn't he?
He has. And there's a story in Family of Secrets about that. I guess you recall that he had produced some sort of a report and he sent it in and he wrote down a bunch of stuff and he was excoriated by his commanding officer, who said, "Don't ever put this stuff down on paper." And he certainly took that to heart, and he became a very, very secretive man, and so secretive that he knew how to he went to great extreme measures to sort of not be implicated in much of anything. And we see this playing out in matters like Iran-Contra, where in all likelihood he was a key figure, an instigator, whatever you want to call it, the Bay of Pigs invasion, where it appears that he was an important figure there. And then as I get into my book, indications that something was afoot, Dallas in 1963, that George Herbert Walker Bush again was part of, but he was so careful. And what I do in Family of Secrets is I go through some instances where we can actually unravel that despite his care, we can see where he's creating alibis and misleading paper trails and so forth. But in the end, of course, those things are also the things that show what he was really doing.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned Zapata Oil, and his partner in starting that up was a guy named Thomas Devine. And he very much was a CIA employee. So you can definitely tell there was an early connection to some degree. And I actually was really impressed how personally involved you got with this investigation. You actually called Thomas Devine up yourself, and outside of a little back and forth, he was instructed by HW not to cooperate, right?
That's right. He actually, you know, at this point he was, I guess, well in his 80s or something. And he just, when I called him, he didn't deny anything. He sort of was very careful. He said, oh, I see. And what is this about? And, well, let me make some calls and get back to you, you know, which is exactly what you expect the consummate intelligence officer to do. He was sort of unflappable. Had no reason to know that I was going to call him. But then he actually asked me whether my book was authorized or approved. And I thought that was very interesting because, of course, the establishment, and this is one of the main themes in Family of Secrets in my work throughout my career, and a key point that we focus on with our news site, whowhatwhy.org, is about how the public perceptions are manipulated through a controlled media. And we see this in the form of the book publishing industry. That's one component of it, where, for example, there a book came out not that long ago by the former editor of Newsweek, and it was very much an authorized biography of George H.W. Bush. Even though my book was already out for a number of years, even though it's a bestseller, he completely ignored all of the revelations in there and went back to the old stories, all the old phony stuff that that the Bushes have been putting out. And of course, he, unlike me, was invited on to all the major television shows and radio, and they staggeringly, and this is revealing about the fundamental corruption of the media, not just the media, but academia and book publishing and so forth, that they are perfectly able to just look the other way and act like none of this scholarship or research has been done, play the game, and have these kinds of people on there with their mythologies. And so, you know, they don't go and call the Thomas Devines and, you know, ask George Herbert Walker Bush what he was doing on November 22, 1963 in Dallas, and why he was having lunch that week with a man named Alfred Ulmer, an old friend of his who was the former CIA bureau chief in a number of countries when there was a military coups and when there were attempts to overthrow leaders who the U.S. Disapproved of. None of that ever seems to make it into those books that are the only ones that most people hear about, because they hear about almost all this stuff not through shows like yours, but through the traditional media.
Right. And that is a component we've been looking at a lot recently, this PR machine that these elites have. Rockefeller had a great one, and the Bushes are obviously no different. But I think a lot of people think these books are just kind of ego service, but clearly they're more than that. They use these books to kind of fudge their backstory and create their alibis in some senses. And you see this pretty clearly when it comes to their military record, especially in Poppy Bush's case, right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, when I looked at his World War II service, and of course that, you know, that he was a war hero, you know, a decorated pilot who had survived the downing of his plane. This was all part of what they used when he ran for office. And as I began looking at that, I was fascinated with that story because he was the pilot, his plane went down, his crew members died, and he survived. And of course, being a journalist, I said, you know, I'd like to know more about the particulars there, because, you know, the famous saying that the captain of the ship is to be the last one to leave. And I wanted to know more about it. And as I looked into it, I discovered that he had told several different dramatically conflicting versions of what had happened and why he had survived while his crewmates had perished. And in fact, also that other witnesses, including a man in the plane right behind his, disputed his story that his plane had been hit and badly derailed, and that he had no choice, crippled, but to bail out. And his story that when he bailed out, he thought everybody else had already left the plane. So that kind of story. And then of course, people say, well, that's so distasteful. How can you question somebody's military record and their heroism? It's very, very selective because, of course, they had no problem questioning John Kerry's record. Yet the fact is that John Kerry, you know, volunteered for swift boat service, and whatever you want to say about that, that was incredibly harrowing type of work. And he did it. And yet they were able to raise questions about whether he was a coward and so on. And so it's a very cynical machine that makes some people suspect. They went after George McGovern in 1972, though George McGovern had been a flyer in World War II and a hero. And they made Nixon out to be a tough guy. But, I mean, he wasn't involved practically at all in World War II. He basically was belatedly got involved because he knew he would have a political career as a sort of a supply officer on a ship. And so this is what they do. They look for their enemy's strengths, and they try to turn those into weaknesses.
Right. Yeah, it's all about perception. And another note I had here about Zapata Oil is apparently they had a rig off the coast of Medellin, Colombia during some key years. And of course, we're talking a lot about the CIA connections. So it begs the question, did drug running come up at all in your investigation of the Bush's wealth creation schemes?
Well, first of all, as far as Medellin, it's very, very strange because Medellin is not on the coast. It's inland and in Colombia. And as far as I know, and I'm not an expert on this, and I wasn't able to do massive amounts of research, but what research I could do, it seemed to me, and I'd be happy to be corrected on this, that back in that period, which was the early 60s, Medellin was not yet an active center in the drug trade. So I don't know what to make of that. What we found was that Zapata had hired a judge who had helped fix the 1948 Senate election of Lyndon Johnson. This is a whole other area about the unusual ties between the Bushes and Johnson, though they were ostensibly from opposite parties. They had hired this man, Judge Manuel Bravo, and then given him this job in Medellin, Colombia. Now, it would look like kind of like a no-show job. Why they hired him, why he went there, if they were, you know, did he have to leave the country? Was he looking for a sinecure? I don't know that. That all deserves more research, but it was very, very strange that they hired him, that they sent him to Colombia, that they even had an office in Medellin, because it's not one of the ports in Colombia where you would expect to find an offshore drilling company.
Yeah, man, it's a curious thing. And I figured I just had to ask. I know it's not a big part of the book, but alarm bells start going off when you hear about Medellin, Colombia. And when people start talking about drug running, it always tends to come up. So
it does. And let me just say, by the way, that I don't want to skirt that issue. The CIA has been extremely complicit in the drug trade throughout the world. We see that even now with the poppies in Afghanistan. But we saw that very much in Laos, where a former Coca-Cola factory had been turned into a giant drug factory, where the planes were being used, the planes of the CIA proprietaries were being used to shuttle drugs. We saw that the allegations regarding the introduction of crack cocaine into America, with the Iran-Contra, with the role of the drug trade there. The intelligence world has always, you know, they move huge amounts of money. Probably the biggest activity of these, the term intelligence, by the way, is a misnomer, because although that's the most acceptable work that we would see these organizations doing, it's often the most dismissed internally. It's the covert operations or the often illegal, aggressive behavior, from, you know, sabotage to blackmail to assassination, that often define these organizations. And another part, and probably the biggest part of what they do, is bribery, moving billions of dollars a year to finance student and labor leaders and journalists all over the world that are not only supplying information but operating on behalf of so-called American interests. And how do you move that money? Well, you can't just move it visibly, and so you move it in other forms, whether it's and I get into all this in my book Family of Secrets. I get into the use of drugs, the use of gold the use of all different substitute forms. There's art, there's property, of course, shell companies. There's many, many different ways of moving this. But drugs has been a very, very important part of that. And at a minimum, these entities, including when George H.W. Bush was running it, were very much at least looking the other way, if not explicitly condoning it.
Right. We recently did a show looking at the Clintons, and when Bill was governor of Arkansas, coke running with the CIA through the airport there, there's a lot of speculation that they were involved in that. So I figured I'd ask, of course, with the CIA connections. And another thing that came up in that show on the Clintons is the fact that a lot of their opponents and critics over the years have sometimes gone missing. And that came up more than once. Have you seen any of this kind of thing with the Bush clan?
In the sort of work I do, there are so many strange stories and so many situations where key witnesses, my work relating to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, we see scores of people who had untimely deaths simply vanished from the face of the earth. We see that again and again and again. I mean, one of the stories, which I don't even think this is in Family of Secrets, but there was a story of a young woman who supposedly had been impregnated by one of the Bushes out in West Texas. And I talked to people who knew about that story. But as far as the young woman, what I was told was that she and her entire family simply vanished. Some vehicle showed up and all of their belongings were put into it and they were never seen again. So, yes, these kind of things definitely do happen.
Jesus. Man, and I've heard you say something to the effect that the Bushes are just the worker bees of the network. And, you know, they're obviously some of the most public figures in it. But what can you tell us about maybe their bosses?
Well, you know, everybody's always looking for a cabal of a number of, you know, people who meet together and control everything. And you hear all these things over the years. In long term, you hear about, you know, the various groups and families like the Rothschilds and so on. And, you know, of course, all of those play a role. But the reality is that these things shift. And which families and which individuals and which organizations and which networks, they're not necessarily constant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every family, I'm sure you know that the not everybody is in lockstep, and siblings don't always agree, and the children don't always want to be involved in the family business in the same way. So it makes it difficult to do this kind of work. But just to give you an example, the story about the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and the ranch that he was on. Very interesting to take a close look at the man whose ranch it was. These are very wealthy people who are not in the limelight. We've never heard of them. They tend to own companies that, you know, manufacture. In his case, I want to say there was some kind of, I think, industrial vehicles, I believe. You know, we don't think about a lot of those industries and, you know, things like dresser industries. We don't think about oil derricks and drilling mud and those kinds of things. We you know, even today, what do we hear about? We hear about the Bill Gateses, the Twitter billionaires, the people who make the devices and the products, Apples, that we use and that we revere. But our lives are made functional and comfortable by the, you know, the air conditioning equipment and the inside our phone are, you know, minerals that were mined by other companies and, you know, who makes all kinds of things, the insulation in our houses. We tend not to think about those things, but those are companies, and those companies deal very much at the base level of manufacturing and of the need for a constant flow of resources, generally, often, either from places in the United States where there are competing interests, environmental groups, and so forth, or bringing it from abroad where often the people in that country are being underpaid, much against their will, for their country's heritage and for their labor.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are all of these interests in maintaining that kind of status quo and that kind of advantage. And, you know, the Koch brothers, nobody had heard of them, or very few people had heard of them more than a few years ago. And so we need a good media good investigative media and researchers to be constantly studying these families, these individuals, and so on. And it's not that simple. It's very, very difficult.
Right. Yeah, it seems like a real life Game of Thrones to some extent. And, you know, one of the most suspicious things about Poppy Bush is that when questioned, he said he just couldn't recall where he was when JFK was shot, which you've alluded to a couple of times so far. And it's got to be rare for any American, really. But why do you think he's been so coy about where he was at the time?
I wanted to know the answer to that, or to put it another way, I simply just wanted to fill in that piece of his history to find out where he was when, as the question went, where were you when you heard that the president had been shot, which is something that anybody who was probably 5 years old or over at that time could answer, just like as they could about 9/11 and so forth. I mean, I was just wanted to know sort of where he was. And so I went through what I could of his records, his papers, books he had written, interviews with him, and he's totally silent about it. In fact, he doesn't even, he's sort of like, he'll have a history and he'll describe and he'll say, in 1962, the U.S. was doing this, and in early 1963, the U.S. was doing this, and the president and I was doing this and this and this. And then suddenly it's 1964, and I'm like, hello. You know, the president of the United States was assassinated in one of the more spectacular acts of a century of the history of the country, and he's killed in Texas where Mr. Bush lived. Mr. Bush in 1963 was a candidate for the first time for the United States Senate, running on the opposite platform, critical of Kennedy. And how could he not even say something about that day? And that just seems so strange to me. So I began taking a close look, and the result in my book, Family of Secrets, is five chapters in a book about the Bush family that veers off into the Kennedy assassination. And, the book I'd like people to read it, and there's a lot there. We don't have time here to go into all the detail, but essentially that's where I began to focus on the indications that he was doing intelligence work in 1963, and that he was connected to an array of individuals who were involved with the CIA cover corporations and what have you, who were in and out of Dallas at that time. I was astonished to find out that George H.W. Bush was a lifelong friend of a man by the name of George Demoranshild, a Russian emigre from a wealthy Russian family that had problems when the Russian Revolution took place, part of a network of very wealthy Russian emigres who were involved in the early days of the American intelligence apparatus, also involved with the oil industry and other such things. And there was George Demoranshild, and he was a friend of George H.W. Bush, dating all the way back to the 1930s, when George H.W. Bush was a very young fellow, and that George Demoranshild also was a very, very close friend of the man who we are told shot and killed John F. Kennedy. And that was Lee Harvey Oswald. And when I saw that George H.W. Bush was, that it is documented that he was a longtime associate and friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend, and that Bush went on to become the director of the CIA, and he has never uttered a word about any of this, I said, well, to begin with, I mean, that's obviously a sort of malpractice of a person in intelligence work, because what could be more important in intelligence work than preventing the President of the United States from being assassinated or figuring out who had done it? And so the fact that he was one step removed from the killer of the president and never saw fit to look into that or talk about that in itself, of course, is just an incredible red flag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the George Demoranshild connection is pretty telling, definitely, especially that it goes back so many years before the assassination, going back to the 30s. I mean, they clearly knew each other. And there's also strong indications that Poppy Bush was actually in Texas at the time of the assassination, right?
That's right. I discovered a little notice in a newspaper, which had clearly been overlooked by everyone. And when I found that, I said, oh boy, because it was a meeting of a oil drillers association. It was being held November 21. That's the night before the John F. Kennedy was shot at 12:30 on November 22 in Dallas. This was the night before. This was November 21. It was an evening meeting, and there was a George H.W. Bush speaking at this gathering. And so I was able to at least establish that he was in Dallas the night before. We know that the next day, early in the afternoon, he was in another place near Dallas. We do not know where he was at what point he left Dallas. So we know he was at Dallas the night before. We know he was near Dallas as of 1:45 p.m. We don't know where he was the intervening hours. We know that he was meeting, as I say, that week with a man who was in charge of CIA coups overseas. We know that he was one step removed from Lee Harvey Oswald. We know that his central running mate for when he ran for U.S. Senate, the man who would be the Republican nominee for governor, was a high-level military intelligence person, closely connected to him, closely connected into not only the military, but also into the Dallas Police Department. And in Family of Secrets, I go into this in great detail because there's a lot there. It's pretty complicated.
It is, but it's been long suspected that the assassination was a CIA operation, so I wouldn't be surprised if he was involved to some degree.
Well, it's also important to remember that his family were very, very close personally with Alan Dulles, who was the CIA director who Kennedy had deposed, had removed. Mm. And so Alan Dulles and his network of top people were removed from the CIA, and they remained at large in a sense because they left at the end of 61 after the failed Bay of Pigs and so forth. They, in 1962, there were 2 years in which Alan Dulles and all of his top coup plotters were essentially not working. And again, you've got, as I say, the Bush family, Prescott Bush and his son, George H.W., very, very closely tied into that network. It's all documented in tremendous detail in Family of Secrets. And there's no question that there was a real animus for Kennedy on the part of this group. And it's also very interesting, the details of Alan Dulles. I mean, Alan Dulles visited Dallas shortly before Kennedy was killed, ostensibly because he was writing a book about intelligence, and he was working on the book with E. Howard Hunt, another person, CIA person, very closely tied into all kinds of covert operations, alleged to have known some things, to have been somewhat witting, perhaps, to what happened to John F. Kennedy. So you see all these strands, and everybody knew each other, and I'm not suggesting that the CIA itself officially or formally was involved, because I highly doubt that. I don't think that you do those sorts of things on a basis where they can ever be formally connected to any kind of a government agency. I'm sure there were plenty of people in the CIA who asked would not have been willing to do something like that, but I think that this group of people who were inside, were outside now, and their friends and colleagues who were inside were perhaps able to help along something that had a lot of different groups that were interested in seeing the president removed. And then it goes again into their ties to all these different groups and segments of society. And in Family of Secrets, I have one whole chapter where I just go into all the different people who were furious with Kennedy and would love nothing better than to see him no longer in the White House.
Right, and great points. It does seem like it's one of their tricks to act as a type of covert parasite or backseat driver, in a sense, inside some of these larger organizations, because then they're harder to single out. You can never really properly pinpoint these people moving within the larger circle. So investigators get sloppy and say things like, oh, it was the CIA. Okay, well, that's not really detailed enough. And these string pullers know that. It's another level of security for them.
That's actually a fundamental way. You've just touched on a fundamental way that these things operate, because the key word is secret. So everything's secret. That means that even inside an organization, most everything is still secret. It's compartmentalized. There are layers of deception and obfuscation. There are very few records. What records there are often themselves cover for what is really going on. And this goes back again to George H.W.'s experience in the Navy in World War II, where he learned about this, that that's what they do. And also what they do is that they piggyback on other things. And so you try to find natural things. So for example, the alleged role of organized crime in the Kennedy assassination. Well, sure. The role of anti-Castro Cubans or the far right in America or the oil industry. Well, sure. All of these segments want, you know, they hated Kennedy and they were only too delighted to see him taken out. And so, did they have an agenda? Could they have been involved in running perhaps multiple plots? Absolutely. And so the goal in intelligence work is deniability. They always use assets that they don't do it themselves. You almost never have actual CIA payroll employees who are committing murders or anything else. It's always many steps removed. And moreover, they look for people who are criminals. They're experienced criminals. They're only happy to do anything to get paid for it. And they themselves are easy to discredit if and when they go public because they're criminals. Mm-hmm. And so this is the sort of foolproof way that these things can be done. And so for those in the traditional media and academia and book publishing and what have you, who always put out this line that someone would have talked or it's ridiculous, it's too complicated, it could never have been done. They understand almost nothing about how these things are done and are done constantly throughout the world.
I also, before we go, I wanted to ask you about your website, Who, What, Why, a little bit. Tell us about that project and some of the stories that you're covering there.
I started Who, What, Why, I began playing around with it right around the time that I was starting to write Family of Secrets. Already then, even before I was shut out with the book, I already had a sense that there were important stories that could not be told in the media. And I experienced that in my years of working for respected news organizations in the United States and around the world. I could see that you had to self-censor, that you could not get into these kinds of fascinating and important topics that you and I have been discussing today. And I saw that there was a need to create a whole new media that was not accountable to the establishment. But I also saw that the so-called alternative media wasn't the solution I had in mind either, because of the propensity to preach to the converted and to follow a particular party or ideological line. Mm-hmm. And I really, what I was seeking was to whether it was possible to create a more pure journalism, closer to the type of journalism that I was hoping to be part of when I was studying journalism and being told that this is what we ought to aspire toward. I looked for a journalism that was a combination of the best qualities of the so-called mainstream media and the alternative media, meaning as objective and as fair and as unbiased as possible going in to look at things and open to any discoveries or outcomes regardless of whom it might offend, but at the same time being willing to draw conclusions and to not have false equivalencies between, on the one hand, powerful enterprises that are fundamentally self-serving and smaller entities that do have public-spirited missions that are, say, nonprofits and things. And we realize that we don't want to create equivalencies, that when a giant corporation says something, it may be true, but we understand that their job is to make money and to keep their positions. And that, you know, sometimes when an environmental organization, someone else says something, it may be untrue or exaggerated or serving their own purposes, but that the missions of those two entities are fundamentally different and we ought to look at them differently and their biases and their agendas and so forth when we talk to them. And so, we try to encompass all of these things and take them all into consideration. Who, What, Why is a nonprofit. And unlike a lot of nonprofits, we are not taking large sums of money from big establishment foundations. We also do not accept any advertisements of any kind. And so it is very difficult to do what we do because every penny that we take in and every penny that we pay to our writers and our editors is donated by ordinary people, by Americans and peoples to a minor extent around the world, wherever they may be. There are people elsewhere who care about America having good journalism. It affects them too. But in any case, we have run it on a shoestring. We continue to run it on a shoestring. We're hoping that the donations from people who read our site will continue to grow and people will support us so that we can expand. We are expanding. We'd like to expand much more. We would like to become a major news organization, a first or second read, if you will, where people can go on a daily or even hourly basis when something happens in the world and they say, I want to know what's really going on and I want to read quality work by skeptical, serious, fair-minded diggers. That's what we seek to do. We think it makes us not wholly unique, but largely unique in the totality of what we represent. We also like to combine that with liveliness, fun, bit of a sense of humor, edgy headlines and pictures. And we're going to keep on experimenting and introducing new concepts all the time. We welcome members of the public to get involved, particularly those who have any kind of professional skills that any organization, not just a news organization, can use. We welcome people in everything from social media to marketing to management to technology. We also welcome people who have skills in research or reporting or writing or editing or video, all of these kinds of things. We're going to grow it as a people-powered enterprise, and we hope and expect to be around for a very, very long time.
Mm. Amen, man. Noble effort for sure. It seems like we have very similar philosophies in the way to do these kind of things. And that about does it for us. So informative, very insightful look at the Bush dynasty, way more content than we could cover in just one conversation. I really do appreciate your time. Are there any new projects or websites to point people towards if they want to follow up on you a bit more?
The elements are pretty simple. whowhatwhy.org, O-R-G, meaning we are a nonprofit. That's the website. We have a Twitter account, at whowhatwhy. We have a Facebook page. We're also on some other social media platforms. We love it when people share our stories through any means at all. People can donate by going to the site. They can volunteer by going to the site. They can write to us by going to the site. I also have that book we talked about, Family of Secrets, which can be bought in bookstores or online, various forms, including hardback, paperback, ebook, audiobook. And I've got my own Twitter where I have my more personal reflections. That's at Real Russ Baker, R-E-A-L, Russ Baker. And I am working on a new book about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It's been in the works for a number of years. I'm hoping it won't be too many more years before that is out.
Mm. Awesome. Well, great. Russ, it's a pleasure talking to you. Keep doing the important stuff that other people won't and take care of yourself out there. It is a dangerous game.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest and your thoughtful questions.
Boom, people. There we go. Good times. Another show in the bag. I think I incorrectly said at the beginning whowhatwhy.com, but it's actually .org if you haven't figured that out yet. You can also look at the links that come with this show, and they'll take you right to it. But good episode, right? Russ does a lot of great stuff, but this book, Family of Secrets, is definitely my Bush family textbook now. It's over 2 inches thick, very well sourced. It's going to give you what you need when you start to forget the details of what's so bad about him, if such a thing were even possible. See, we've talked about Poppy Bush's involvement with the CIA and heavily speculated that it was an older and deeper relationship than the 1 year where he was director, but it's always good to go back and look at the evidence and the paper trail that verifies it. We don't want to be hyperbolic. We don't want to be overly speculative because these are the things that make us look crazy and people don't listen. So I thought this was a return to just what we needed, and plus, a guest who knows what he wrote and can have an educated conversation about it is key. This is where I tried to focus my next few guests after a few speculative UFO and life-after-death communication shows. They have a place, but I'd rather them be a once-in-a-while type of thing rather than a type of topic and approach that defines us. I'd much rather have something like today's show be the standard. But I think this was a good time breaking down just how an elite family like the Bushes operates. And I'm sure there's obviously a lot more and a lot deeper we could go, and we will, since this obviously isn't the last time the Bush family is going to come up, but it does lay a nice base. So do check out whowhatwhy.org for Russ's further geopolitical analysis. Hit him up on Twitter. Let him know you like the show. We want the good guests to know they're not speaking into a vacuum. We do have people listening out there, right? I think so. And speaking of listeners, I do appreciate your time, and I try to be a podcast that doesn't waste it. Some shows are heavily speculation, but I still want to go there. I've heard a few people talking on various podcasts lately, and they mock conspiracy theorists and say that they want their standard to be things that we know to be absolutely true, and that's a ridiculous catch-22 standard, because they cite things like the Gulf of Tonkin incident or Operation Northwoods, and yeah, those are great pieces of evidence that there's a hidden hand manipulating events. But these things are so old, and the only reason that you feel comfortable talking about them is because they've been verified by the official source. So where does that leave a person like this on something like 9/11? You're just going to wait until 2045 where the government finally comes out and says, yeah, we did that. Because that day might come when enough time goes by. After a few generations, it's all new people, and they don't really feel responsible for the crimes of old, and sometimes they come out. But if your standard is that things need to be verified by official mainstream sources that are controlled by the very people who are perpetrating these crimes, then you're caught in a place where you're never really going to understand what's going on. So you do need to speculate. You do need to look at things like Operation Northwoods and the Gulf of Tonkin incident and say, yeah, these are the things we can verify, and these are the things that allow me to realize 9/11 fits a certain template that had been suggested before and carried out before. That's its usefulness. Not to say these are real conspiracies and 9/11 is just wild speculation. You can't wait to accept these things until they've been proven in a court of law, because a lot of times that isn't going to happen. It's about recognizing patterns, identifying agendas, and looking at events and saying, does this fit? Does this further their goals? If it does, you can probably assume it wasn't random. You should be able to take an event and say that even though you can't fully verify it based on things in the past and the agenda going forward, something's fishy here. You know, something just doesn't smell right. And I know that sometimes the speculation goes too far. I guess that's my point. And that's what a show like this does. It breathes. It goes out maybe a little too far and then it pulls back. But we should take what we know and extrapolate further on it, not just stop there and think that, oh, that must be all there is to know. Edward Snowden told us all about the surveillance problems with the NSA, and they tell me that on the news, and I think he's a legitimate whistleblower, and that's probably the extent of these programs. Or, hey, I can study history and recognize half a dozen false flags, but I'm sure those don't happen anymore. Like, that's a really bad approach to things, even if you think that we sometimes take it to extremes that seem ridiculous. You gotta question everything. Because personally, I say fuck 'em. I'd rather go too far than not far enough. And what's with these vague statements? You're thinking, Carl, would just tell us what you're saying. What are you referring to? Well, I'm referring to a lot of things. I'm referring to recent events in Orlando. I'm referring to last week's show. And I'm just talking about a general approach I like to apply to all of these things. That's all. I'm rambling. But the next show is going to be really interesting in this context. I already recorded it, and it goes deeper into the idea of weaponized medicine and vaccines than we ever have before. And this author also had quite a lot of documentation and research showing that it goes a lot further than just a tainted polio vaccine in the 50s. I think it's going to be one of those episodes that lights a lot of people up. Some shows are just primed for a big response, good or bad. I just know. Today's episode probably didn't surprise a lot of people, but it's good to have some examples and concrete details about this kind of corruption. So when someone asks you at Thanksgiving dinner, well, what is it exactly about the Bushes that you hate so much? Now you have a good amount of ammunition and you don't even have to invoke 9/11. It's good to be educated and to be able to back up your points. And thanks to guys like Russ, doing the hard work to put it all together, All we have to do is familiarize ourselves with it. But if you like the first hour, you know how to get more. Just sign up for THC Plus for $5 a month. You're getting 5 2-hour shows. I know that everyone is doing this goddamn model now, but you just got to go with the shows that you think do the best job. And I hope I'm one of them. In the second hour of today's show, we got into how Richard Nixon was a Bush dynasty puppet, details about how Poppy Bush groomed and nurtured people within his oil drilling company, the rise of George W. Bush, how he used family connections to climb the political ladder despite the skeletons in his closet and the lack of qualifications to run the country, how the Bushes are connected to the Saudi royal family in the Middle East, and how that might connect to Al-Qaeda and 9/11, things we're still dealing with today, and honestly, just a lot more ammunition for that inevitably awkward holiday family argument. You're gonna have it, you might as well win. But that's about it for me. Keep your head up in these troubled times, and I'll see you soon. Your move, Bush Dynasty, and the pathetic puppets drunk on the illusion of power caught in their wicked web. Your fucking move.
They built a little empire out of some crazy garbage called the blood of the exploited working class. But they've overcome their shyness. Now we're calling them your highness. And the world screams, save me, THC. They destroyed the bonds of friendship and respect between the only people left who'd even look them in the eye. Now they laugh and make a fortune off the same ones that they tortured. And a world screams, save me, THC. Let's look for Jesus, some will say. The blood of the exploited working class. But they've overcome their shyness. Now we're calling them your highness. And the world screams, save me, THC.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehiresidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the 5 shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the form, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site if you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices. I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the 5 shows the previous month, and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?